Okay, good morning. Every once in a while, Robin gives me an opportunity to speak in church. I think it's very brave of him, actually, and I'm very grateful to him. My message today is continuing our series that we've been doing, looking at the miracles of Jesus. As many of you probably know, in between trips to Africa and being Tom and Ellie's mum and dad and Judy's husband, I'm also a teacher. I teach in the high school at Stratford. And good practice as a teacher means that you really need to engage all of the senses of your students. Different people learn in different ways. Some people are visual learners. They learn by seeing things. Some people are auditory learners. They learn by listening. And some people are tactile learners. They learn by doing. And I guess probably all of us are a little bit of those things. But if you think about it, you'll probably find that one of them appeals to you more than others. Now, I hope I'll be able to engage at least all of those three senses in the next 25 minutes or so. And whatever kind of learner you are, I really do pray that this morning God will speak to you through this message. The text for this morning is Matthew 14, verses 22 to 33. If you've got Bibles, if you want to find that, we'll be staying there. But the same miracle is also found in Mark chapter 6, verses 45 to 52, and John 6, 15 to 21. It's a story I'm sure that you all know, but I'd like to introduce it musically this morning as an invitation. Water, and this is something I got from a fantastic kids website. Actually, I just liked it. It's a nice way of illustrating the story, I think, featuring the art of Henry Martin. After Jesus had fed the 5,000, he told the disciples to get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side. Then he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. By evening, the boat had sailed a great distance from the land. Now, when we go to Kenya, there's a place called Lake Victoria, very close to where we are. And it is a huge lake. The little bit of it that we can see is just an inlet. It's actually the second biggest source of fresh water in the world, Lake Victoria. And when you look at this little inlet at Kendu Bay, which is where we take the kids sometimes, I think Judy took them there on Thursday, you can see what looks like a sea going on forever. And it looks very much like that. The boats that they actually use out there for fishing, I could imagine them having used them in any of the stories that Jesus told. And on a calm day, on a fine day, the lake looks great. And the boats sail out, and you think, it must be wonderful to have the freedom to go out and sail on those boats. So Jesus sent the disciples out on a boat. He's gone by himself to pray, and the boat's sailing off into the distance, all well and good so far. As the disciples sailed towards the other side, the wind began to blow and the sea became rough. The sea became so rough that some of the disciples were becoming seasick. So they're having a hard time. Remember, these are fishermen. These are people that are used to being out on the water. They're used to boats, so they're having a really hard time. They looked out at the sea, and guess what they saw? They saw Jesus walking towards them on the water. Now, while I was researching this sermon, I looked on the internet for some ideas and some assistance, and there are lots of attempts at explaining this miracle in the natural. There's a very bad joke about a rabbi, a priest, and a pastor out fishing, and they run out of worms. So the rabbi runs out, so he walks out of the boat, toddles off across to the quay, picks up the bait and goes back in the boat. And the other guy does the same thing. The last one, the pastor, steps over the side of the boat, falls down, splosh, into the water, no bait. And the other two turn around to himself. Do you think we ought to tell him about the rocks? So there's a natural explanation. Jesus knew where the coral reef was and he toddled across that. I saw an even more inventive one, which some scientist had actually put together. And he'd looked at all sorts of data. You know, data kind of seems to rule our lives sometimes these days, and facts and information. And this scientist had looked at weather patterns in the particular lake at the time. And he'd come to the conclusion that it was just possible that Jesus was actually floating on a fairly thick piece of ice, because the weather had kind of, the lake had frozen. So he was actually properly walking on the water, but it was frozen water, so it was a bit of a cheat as well. But we all know, because we believe the Bible is the infallible word of God, we believe what it says in there, and we believe that Jesus walked on the water towards the disciples. And if I was one of the disciples, I'd have had the same reaction, I think. When they saw him, they were terrified and cried out in fear, "It's a ghost." They freaked out. "Don't be afraid. It is I," Jesus said. I think one of the things that's amazed me about Jesus and the things that are written about him in the Bible is he's the master of understatement. He doesn't waste words. "Don't be afraid, it is I," Jesus said. And that's all he really needed to say, wasn't it? They were terrified. "Don't be afraid." Well, why not? "Because it's me." Very simple. "Lord, if it's you," Peter said, "tell me to come to you on the water." And we can see Peter there stood at the prow of the boat ready to leap in. Peter's always the disciple that seems to be up for it. Peter's always the one that wants to seem to make his mark. "Come," Jesus answered. So Peter got out of the boat and began walking on the water toward Jesus, which is a miracle in itself. It was a miracle, Jesus walking over to the boat. It's a miracle that Peter began to walk towards Jesus. But when he saw the waves, he was afraid. And he began to sink. And you can imagine him just sinking like a stone, wondering, "What on earth have I let myself in for? Why did I do that?" "Help, save me," Peter cried. How many of us have been in that situation? How many of us have sat there? How many of us perhaps this morning have sat there thinking, "Help, save me, I need saving"? What did Jesus do? Immediately, Jesus reached out and caught him. And in all of the different translations of this that I've looked at this particular part of the story in, immediately, Jesus reached out and caught Peter. As soon as he'd made the request, as soon as he'd asked, "Save me," Jesus was there, holding out the hand to pull him up and save him. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" And led him back to the boat. And when they climbed back into the boat, the sea became calm. So the sea's calm, the storm's gone, Jesus has sorted the situation out. I'd like to look at five ways of applying this story to our lives, starting with a look at Peter and his character. I've called the first section "Fools Rush In." Now, I think Peter's one of those characters in the Bible who's both inspiring and infuriating. He's inspiring because at different times when none of the other disciples did, he recognized who Jesus was and he put his trust in him. But he's also infuriating because he blows it so often. So often Peter's the disciple that seems to let Jesus down. Peter's the disciple who doesn't really come through. Peter's the one that has spectacular success immediately followed by spectacular failure. As a teacher, I could imagine writing his school report. "Peter has great potential but must resist the temptation to show off in front of his friends. Peter often fails to put his money where his mouth is." That might sound like a bit of a character assassination, but if you read about the Peter of the Bible, he seems to be a man like that. But let's just consider him as he builds up to his walk on the water. The text makes it clear to us that the disciples in the boat were in a bad situation. As I said a minute ago, there were men that were used to being in boats, used to being on the water, and they knew that the wind that had blown up around them wasn't good news. They knew that it was a perilous situation. In the New King James Version, it says, "The boat was being tossed by the waves, and the wind was contrary." Can't imagine a contrary wind, but a contrary wind had blown up, and they were being tossed about in this little boat. Ellie may remember this, because I think she was with us, when we went for a ride in a boat in Lake Victoria. And we had some friends with us, and the guy that was doing the boat tour said, "Why don't you all just pile in this boat, and we'll go for a sail around the little inlet," which we'd done before, so we thought, okay, it's fine, we know this guy. And as we got into the boat, it began to sink lower and lower into the water, until I think it was about that there was about that much clearance between the top of the boat and the top of the lake. And at this point, Judy freaked out and insisted on another boat, so we got into another boat. And as we sailed out, they actually put the sail up, which was actually quite an experience sailing on a lake like that under sail. And it went quite fast, and the waves were quite choppy. That was on a good day. These guys were fishermen, and they're very worried. Peter as well, to start with. In the middle of this storm, in the small hours of the morning, the disciples see a figure walking across the water towards them, which fuels their fear. They aren't just scared now, they're terrified. Jesus calls out to them to reassure them, tells them not to be afraid, and to be of good cheer, as it says in one of the translations. You can imagine that, wandering across the lake, said, "Just be of good cheer, chaps, I'm coming." You can understand perhaps why the disciples were a bit doubtful, but Peter isn't. His instinct is to call out to Jesus and say, "If it is you, command me to walk on the water with you." He's the apostle who's up for it. Jesus says, "Come," and Peter gets out of the boat, with the storm raging around him. Could you imagine doing that? Can you imagine stepping over the side of a boat in the middle of a wind when the boat's being tossed about by the waves, expecting to walk out to Jesus? He walks a small distance towards Jesus on the water. And then, when he takes his eyes off Jesus and realizes where he is and what he's doing, he starts to sink. He calls out to Jesus, "Save me." And immediately, Jesus reaches out his hand, lifts him out of the water, and takes him back to the safety of the boat. On the way back to the boat, Jesus asks Peter, "Why did you doubt?" Now, I think that's quite a significant point in the story about Jesus' character. Jesus is the ultimate people person. Jesus builds us up. Jesus never knocks us down. Jesus never rebukes us in a way that would belittle us. His rebuke to Peter isn't a public dressing down designed to make him look foolish in front of the other disciples. In the middle of the storm, I don't think the disciples would have heard what Jesus said to Peter, but Peter did. And when he and Jesus got back into the boat, the wind ceased, and in the Bible it says a worship session started as the disciples recognized who Jesus was and praised him. And sometime later, after Jesus' death and resurrection, Peter, the disciple who sank into the lake, the disciple who has got such great potential but likes to show off in front of his friends, he raised his voice and led 3,000 new believers to Christ. When I was in Kenya this time, we do a Bible study on a Wednesday, and one of the things I looked at was Peter and his character, and how somebody who would appear in so many ways to be such a disappointment to Christ, how somebody who, like his right-hand man who let him down, became such a powerful man of God after Jesus' death and with the Acts church. So, how are we to interpret Peter's rash attempt to walk with Jesus on the water and his subsequent doubt? Well, one thing I guess we could say is that Peter was obviously showing off and that he achieved nothing. It would be very tempting to do that, especially if we think, well, we know a little bit about Peter. But that would ignore the fact that he actually did walk on the water. He did walk some of the distance out to Christ, only briefly. But Peter's failures alert us to the need to recognize Jesus and to respond to him, to call out to him. Jesus expects us to emulate him. I think that's a significant teaching out of this story and in John 14:12. In John 14:12, Jesus tells the disciples, "The person who trusts me will not only do what I'm doing, but even greater things, because I, on my way to the Father, I'm giving you the same work to do that I've been doing." Jesus wants to empower us, to encourage us to do what he did. Peter's brief walk on the water shows us what's possible if we trust Jesus, and equally that we can't do anything worthwhile without him. Is there a bit of Peter in you, cautiously calling out to Jesus, hesitantly stepping out, and then finding yourself sinking as you began to doubt the wisdom of trusting Jesus? Before we consider a second interpretation of the story, I'd like to ask another question. If Peter was showing off, and if the other 11 disciples thought, "There he goes again," as Peter stepped off the side of the boat, what were they hoping would happen to him? Remember, these are men that know each other fairly well. I'm sure you can think of a group or groups of people that you know to the same extent. And they knew all about Peter's character. They may well have thought, "Oh, it's that show-off Peter again," or "There he goes again, the rash, impulsive man stepping off the boat." But what did they hope would happen to him? Well, some of them sat there thinking, "Well, I hope he drowns. Would serve him right. I just hope Peter sinks out of sight and that would be it." Are you thinking, or are they thinking, "Well, I just hope he gets his comeuppance. You know, he's always doing stuff like that. He's always leaping in, feet first, shooting his mouth off. Let's hope he gets his comeuppance from this one." Or were they there, any of them, at the side of the boat, cheering him on, actually saying, "Go on, Peter, you can make it out to Jesus"? Put yourself in their shoes. What would you have been wishing on Peter? How do you feel about brothers and sisters in Christ when they step out? Are you an encourager like Jesus was? Or are you half hoping they'll fail for having had the audacity to step out of the boat? Second way to look at the story of Jesus and Peter's walk on the water is to look at it as an element of comfort and risk. I think the story of Jesus and Peter's walk on the water is a great illustration of the tension between comfort and risk. As I was preparing for this message, I did some research on the internet and I came across some interesting suggestions. There was one quote that I wrestled with quite a long time. It says that in the church today, there are far too many people who prefer the comfort of the boat. Now, I don't intend to preach in a way that I hope condemns anybody at all today, but reflecting on personal experience convinces me that given a straight choice between comfort and risk, most of the time, most of us would go for comfort. Not many of us are the kind of adrenaline junkies that really like risk very much. Some of you might have read a book called If You Want to Walk on Water, You've Got to Get Out of the Boat. And in the book, John Ortberg, the author, invites us to consider some very simple but fundamental questions. And at the end of this message, I'll be setting the homework questions for all the tactile learners, the people that learn by doing. For now, though, I want to focus on one of the questions. If I could have the PowerPoint. Sorry. What is your boat? Now, John Ortberg answers this question by saying, your boat is whatever represents safety to you apart from God himself. Your boat is whatever you are tempted to put your trust in, especially when life gets a little stormy. What are your safety nets? Where are the places that you go to for safety? Your boat is whatever keeps you so comfortable that you don't want to give it up, even if it's keeping you from joining Jesus on the waves. Your boat is whatever pulls you away from the adventure of extreme discipleship. And I just want to leave those quotes up there for a minute. And I would just ask you to reflect on those. Can you identify with any of those questions? Are those questions that you've ever asked yourself? What's my boat? The last one particularly. What keeps you so comfortable that you don't want to give it up? Even if that means you know you're compromising your walk with Jesus. It's a tough question. It's a tough parable. It's a tough story, this one, I think. John Ortberg goes on to give more specific guidance about identifying your boat by saying, want to know what your boat is? Your fear will tell you. Just ask yourself this. What is it that most produces fear in me, especially when I think of leaving it behind and stepping out in faith? What is it that scares you the most about doing what you think God is telling you to do? I'm sure you will have had moments like that when you felt, I'm pretty sure this is God, but it's just too scary. I don't want to go there because it's out of my comfort zone. I've had some interesting moments in Kenya when I found out more about my boat. This trip, I spent just about a month there, I discovered that there are some things about living in the West that I really like, and I don't particularly want to give up. Flushing toilets is one of them, for example. I also struggled with being away from Judy and Tom and Ellie for 3 weeks. I was there on my own for the first 3 weeks. I had a lot to do, but when you're on your own, although familiar, still foreign place, it gives you a lot of time to reflect. And one of the things that I began to do about halfway through that 3 weeks is to really question the value of what we're actually doing out there. And I began to feel a bit sorry for myself and to doubt God's voice because I let fear and I let my comfort zone creep into what I was doing there. Fortunately, God sent a number of people my way during this time to remind me why I was there. People like a lady called Doris, who is 70 years old if she's a day. She came to a church service the first Sunday I was there, and said she didn't feel very well. It turned out that she had typhoid, and she had an infected form of arthritis. What she really needed was a fairly simple amount of medical treatment, some TLC. She stayed on our site for a week, and the ladies that cook looked after her and fed her, and I gave her some water purification tablets to take away with her. And after that week, she perked up a lot. She came to church the next week and she said that her family thought that it was a miracle that she was alive. So ladies like Doris kept me going. There was another lady called Grace who was so badly deformed that she's that shape, Grace. She walks on her hands and knees. She's actually had 2 children and she started a small business that collapsed because she was sick. She got malaria and had to spend all of the money that she had on a treatment for that. So she needed a bit of a boost. We had a little lad called Isaac wandered onto the compound the last Wednesday I was there doing a Bible study with a little green plastic bag with his clothes in. His mother died about 3 years ago, and a good neighbour had taken him in. She was buried the Monday of that week. She died, and the two sons that were left behind kicked this little lad, Isaac, 10 years old, out of the house. So we walked about 15 kilometres to our orphanage because he'd heard somebody say that there's an orphanage there. And he's still there at the moment. We're trying to work out whether we're going to need to keep him until he's grown up or whether the children's officer can do something to help him. But people like those really brought my focus back to, well, you know, your comfort zones are actually fairly pathetic, Terry. Your stamina needs to be pumped up. And people like that reminded me of why God had called Judy and I and everybody else that's involved out to Kenya. There are two little girls that have just started living with us on the orphanage. They actually come to the school. Their grandma's house burnt down at the beginning of the week. They didn't have a lot of alternative but to bring them in. But the teachers have been worried about them anyway because the grandparents just couldn't look after them. So we now have 33 children living in Kaseli. And those 33 children are the most fantastic focus. Judy sent me a text on Friday night. We kind of text each other a lot while we're away. And in the text she said, this walk costs, but it's worth everything. Just ask little Wycliffe, Collins and Doris. So God's been encouraging her in the down times too, because I know she's found some frustrations out there with some of officialdom and some of the things that we've had to do. Now, I've shared these things with you because they're things that have rocked my boat recently. You know, those questions up there, those are the things that were rocking my boat. The comfort of living in this country, the discomfort of being in Kenya on my own for a little while, the discomfort of only having seen Judy for about, I don't know, 6 days or so this whole summer holiday. I hope I'm not whinging. I'm not complaining particularly, but it's something that makes you think. I'd hate you to think that Judy and I are spiritual giants or anything as well. We're just ordinary people, and we fall flat on our faces just as much as anybody else. In some ways, we're really lucky when we come to questions like those, because the place that we go out, if you like, our mission field, is so obviously full of all of the different categories of you should helps in the Bible. You can't move for orphans and widows around our neighbourhood. It's full of widows, orphans, the needy, and the oppressed. So it's not really very difficult to have compassion in Kenya. I think a couple of times while I was out there this time, I began to understand what compassion is about. Because there were a couple of cases. There was a lady who said her house was in need of... She said she needed a new house. It actually needed repairing. But she said that she couldn't sleep anywhere in the house where the rain didn't pour down on her. And for about 2 or 3 days, because I couldn't actually get to see her for 2 or 3 days, I found it very difficult sleeping at night with the rain pounding down on the roof, knowing the situation that she was in. So going out there and working in Kenya, it's not difficult to have, if you like, your compassion level raised and to think, well, the boat's being rocked. And in lots of ways, it's actually much more difficult to do that in England, where everybody has everything, where nobody seems to need Jesus, where nobody seems to need God, where everybody's self-sufficient. But I'd like to encourage you to believe that God can use anybody who makes themselves available to him. I'd like to encourage you to believe, and the 40 Days of Purpose that we'll be launching into in September is I hope, going to help us all to find that. I want us all to believe that God has a ministry and a mission for all of us. He's going to rock our boats sometimes to actually get us out of the water into that ministry or into that mission, but he has something for all of us. Because of the wind and the storm, it might seem very difficult to step out of the boat. But are you staying in your boat because it's a more comfortable place to be? If you get out of the boat, you will face the wind and the storm, but you'll also experience the full and abundant life that Jesus promises. Some of the most amazing times I've ever had in my life have been when I've been at my lowest ebb out in Kenya and God has showed up and said, well, get up, stop feeling sorry for yourself, get on with my work. And there is nothing like responding to that call. There is nothing more rewarding. Outside the comfort of the boat, we have to trust in God, and he's promised that he will never let us down. Jesus didn't wait until Peter was under the waves before he saved him. He reached out his hand immediately, and he will do that for all of us, for every single one of us when we call on him. The third way of interpreting this story is to look at it in terms of fear and doubt and the way that they're the enemies of faith. Now, on a website called sermonsfromseattle.com, I found a very interesting explanation of what a miracle is. And it doesn't show up very well on there, so I'll read it. It says, the focus of miracles isn't on some magical voodoo or natural laws that have been violated. Rather, a God-given miracle is a series of events and the timing of events in such a way that convinces us that God has intervened in our lives. And I found that a really interesting way of looking at miracles. As we focus on the miracles that Jesus performed, we can be tempted, perhaps, to equate them with the spectacular. Jesus definitely performed some spectacular miracles of healing, spectacular miracles of moving in people's lives, spectacular miracles of deliverance, spectacular miracles of feeding people. But I don't believe it's really the size of the miracle that matters. The really important thing is that God shows up. How many times has God done something in your life that you know could only have been him? How many times can you think that happened because God turned up and intervened? However small or however major that intervention was, that was a miraculous intervention by God. How many times has that still small voice spoken to you and said, it's me, it's okay, go for it? And how many times have you followed it? How many times have you ignored it? When Peter started sinking, it was because his faith wasn't big enough to hold him up. He at least had the nerve to step out of the boat when he saw Jesus. The other disciples stayed right where they are. Despite having seen Jesus perform miracles just before they got in the boat, feeding the crowds and healing, they weren't reassured by either his presence or his comforting words. And you really just have to admire Jesus' patience. So many times the disciples just don't get what it is he's trying to show them. I've taught classes like that, year 8 spreadsheets. It does your head in. It drives you mad unless you're Jesus. Mark's version of the story adds an interesting footnote to the disciples' lack of faith. In Mark 6, 51 to 52, it says, as soon as he climbed into the boat, the wind died down. How many times has Jesus climbed into your boat at a stormy time and the winds died down? They were stunned, shaking their heads, wondering what was going on. And this is a really key bit. It said, they didn't understand what he had done at the supper. That's when he fed the 5,000 people. They hadn't understood what it was Jesus was trying to show them. And in the message version, the one I've taken this from, it says, none of this had yet penetrated their hearts. So I don't think it's necessarily that they're unwilling to follow Jesus. It's just that what he has to say hasn't yet penetrated their hearts. How many of us only half trust Jesus or have a half-hearted relationship with him? Jesus' gentle rebuke to Peter is a call for him to trust Jesus completely, backed up by the hand that pulled him out of the water. Which leads us into the fourth area, looking at safety and storms. It's very easy to just focus on Peter and Jesus in this story, but there are 11 other equally important characters. Now, I said a few minutes ago that the disciples were confused. They didn't understand what was going on, which led to them being terrified or helped them, or made them terrified. And it's easy to understand that because when you actually look at the beginning of the story, immediately before the water walk, Jesus had been having a really busy day. Moved by compassion for the crowd that had inevitably gathered around him, he'd healed their sick and taught them many things. Across the three different versions of this story, it says that he did those two things. And as if that wasn't enough, when he looked out at them and he'd been teaching for a long time, he realized they needed feeding, so he fed them miraculously. And immediately afterwards, Jesus insisted that the disciples got into the boats and go on ahead of him while he dismissed the people. So he's helping the disciples again. It's probably been a long day for them as well. They need to go off onto the next place. Jesus is going to dismiss these crowds. He said to the disciples, get in the boat, go across the lake to the next place. And after he dismissed the people, Jesus went to pray by himself. Now, when we start looking at Jesus' work, his ministry, Jesus' stories and parables, it's important to look at the context that it's happening in. It's important to say, well, what happened just before or what happened afterwards? Jesus often went to pray by himself, but there's a possibility that this particular prayer session was a specially important time for him to be with his Father because he needed reassuring and comforting. Just before the feeding of the 5,000, John's disciples had given the sad report that John had been executed by Herod on a whim to please a pretty girl. So Jesus had gone to pray. The disciples had gone onto the lake. And I think one of the reasons that they were confused in the middle of the wind and the waves is because they were doing exactly what Jesus had told them to do. They weren't experiencing this storm. They weren't being knocked about, terrified and tossed by the wind because they hadn't done what Jesus had said. They were being obedient to his command. Bible college with Jesus was proving to be a tough course for them. And the same's true for us. It's perhaps an obvious lesson to learn from this story, but it's still important. How many storms do the disciples experience in their walk with Jesus? Plenty. If I was one of the disciples, by kind of towards the end of the New Testament, any time Jesus would have told me to get in a boat, I'd have wondered what the agenda was, because it seems every time they got in a boat, there was a storm. How many times did Jesus let them down, though? None. Jesus always showed up when he needed to. Jesus always quietened the storm. And we all know this. Jesus is the rock we can depend on. He'll never let us down. He's our savior. But that can all just be so many words. It can be part of a mantra if we aren't attentive to the context of Jesus' compassion, to the very real, very human situations that Jesus ministered in. We've seen earlier that Jesus had recently heard that John the Baptist had been killed. How many of us in our time of loss or grief could still be moved by compassion for other people, for strangers, then hasten to rescue a boat full of unbelieving apprentices? I know out in Kenya, when I was sat there feeling sorry for myself, it was very difficult to feel compassion. It's quite easy to feel the opposite in lots of ways. And that was just a minor inconvenience, really, of being slightly dislocated. What about when you're torn apart by grief? What about when you're aware of what you've got ahead of you? Are you still able to be moved by compassion for strangers? Jesus was always obedient to his Father's will. He had a bottomless well of compassion for the people he'd come to serve, an endless patience for the hapless group of disciples that he led. He didn't quit on people when he was having a hard time, and neither should we. If Jesus is our rock, he should also be our role model. I was listening to Tony Campolo on Premier TV last night, or the night before last, and as usual, his teaching went straight to the point. He said, being a Christian is not just to believe in God. It's letting the Spirit of God be in you and letting God determine what you do. It's to be led by the Spirit of God. If Peter had let the Spirit of God lead him, he would have made it as a water walker. If the disciples had understood what Jesus was teaching them sooner, the praise party would have started earlier. And their fears wouldn't have got the better of them. They wouldn't have been scared by the storm. The last interpretation that I'd like to look at of this story is about the strength of rowing together. And it really locates the real miracle in the last moments when Jesus and Peter are back in the boat. God is always calling us to do the impossible. For many of us, the impossible might seem to be a heroic feat or something superhuman that could only be remotely possible if God did it. But maybe the story of Jesus and Peter's walk on the water is actually, really, about Jesus helping Peter to get back into the boat and helping him to take his place with the others as a part of the group that Jesus had gathered round himself. Perhaps the impossible is actually being part of a small group, a house group, a mission group, or a church faithfully doing God's work. It's in the group that clustered round Jesus in the Bible where impossible things happen. The hungry get fed, the sick get healed, and the lost get saved. When as disciples we are together, rowing together with Jesus in the boat with us, our capacity is increased. Our capacity for compassion is multiplied. And some of us can go to Africa, and some of us can go to Europe. Some of us can minister to the needy in our own town. We all have families. We all have friends. We all have workmates. We're all called to minister, and we're all called to mission. So I'd like to begin concluding today by saying that I have no trouble at all believing that God is in the miracle business, and we've been looking at miracles in this series. The fact that I'm standing here speaking to you this morning is a miracle, and the fact that Judy's just done the same thing to the church over in Africa is equally a miracle for all sorts of reasons. Every single one of us, we each have a personal testimony that should act as an anchor point for our faith and our willingness to believe that God really can do the impossible. Today, I've shared a message with you that has identified fear and doubt as the enemies of faith and obedience. I've suggested that risk-taking is better for your spiritual health than staying in the comfort zone, and encouraged you to believe that riding out storms is often a natural consequence of being obedient to God. I've also asked you to think about the contribution you make as part of the boat's crew. And as long as we keep our eyes on Jesus, we won't drown when we step out of the boat or sink it when we step back in. But it goes deeper, I think. God didn't save us so that we can become boat potatoes or part of a religious organization that meets on Sundays. Christianity isn't meant to be an organization. Christianity is meant to be a movement. A movement that transforms the world that is into the world that ought to be, and we're part of it. Jesus wants us, every single one of us, to be change agents. When we look at the group of men huddled in a boat, rocked by the wind and waves, scared out of their wits, we might struggle to imagine them as men who would change the world. But, with one exception, they did. You might find it hard to believe that we are people who can transform the world that is into the world that ought to be, but we can. It's what God made us for. And if we struggle when we get out of our depth like Peter did, then we're in good company. And if we huddle together in the bottom of the boat together sometimes, that's okay as well. As long as Jesus is in the boat with us, we won't be bound by our fear or doubts for very long. I hope that God's spoken to you today, and I hope that you're all examining your boats and planning your own walk on the water. To help in your preparation for water walking, I'd like to finish this morning by asking you to consider some questions. The first group are from the book, If You Want to Walk on Water, You've Got to Get Out of the Boat. And when I first saw these questions, they probably challenged me more than anything else I'd read for a long time. What is your deepest dream? Second question, how much passion do you experience in your daily life? How much excitement is there in your daily life in serving God? How much are you growing spiritually these days? How often do you take a risk that requires a power greater than your own? If you had to name the one true thing that you believe you were set on this earth to do, what would it be? And if you can answer that question at all, how clear is it to you? How much of it are you doing? And a final question from the purpose-driven life, equally powerful, I think. What would your family and friends say is the driving force of your life? The people that know you, the people that spend a lot of time with you, what would they say drives your life? What would you like it to be? Would the two answers be the same? I believe this parable about walking on the water, this story about walking on the water, is a tough lesson. It works on lots of levels, as so many of Jesus' teachings do. And I hope that you found one of them that you can perhaps begin to relate to and think, there's something I need to do. I'd like to just close in prayer. Lord, please help us to keep our eyes fixed on you. Help us to be bold, to be obedient, to share your compassion for the crowd, and to be world changers. Help us to be change agents filled with your Holy Spirit. Help us to transform the world that is into the world that ought to be. Let your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Help us to know when to step out on the water and when to row with our brothers and sisters. Help us to be unafraid when you ask us, what did you do with what I gave you? Lord, without you, we are helpless. With you, we are unbeatable. Help us to worship you with our lifestyle. Let the way that we live bring you glory, because the power and the glory is all yours. In Jesus' name, amen.